Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson, producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. What do we call Monday? We call Monday Rethink the Week. When do we tape Monday? We tape Monday on Friday mornings. I mentioned to a number of people, actually, I did a radio show this morning, that a lot of people that I love, that I'm very close to, are in hospice, hospice at home or in a professional hospice setting, or have just recently died. Bill Curry, one of our regular guests, he lost a significant other to ALS last week. His comments about her are incredibly beautiful. My 103-year-old friend is at hospice at home, and she too is finally able to sort of say goodbye, and I'm kissing her and saying I love her. And then first employer ever is now in hospice as well. So I wrote on my Facebook page, you guys, and that I'm going to be talking to three people, Robert Hockett, Lincoln Mitchell, and Stephen Pimper. I wrote this on my Facebook page, and I wrote, I am saying goodbye to folks I love and admire. It got me thinking. I still have time to read my obituary. You do too. Now, what is so shocking to me is everybody was talking about the kind of funerals they're planning, what kind of obit they're going to write. And that's not what I meant. What I meant was that you could actually do things differently in your life because you still have time. You can make amends with people that you've hated. You can sort of apologize to your children and try to recreate relationships. All those incredible things. And yet everybody thought I was talking about rewriting their damn obituary. Like I was talking about words and not actions. And I don't know if you're familiar with this story, but I've actually read this on many occasions. And it's a story about Alfred Nobel. And I don't know if you know this, but at least it's apocryphal, it may be real. It's entitled The Surprising Way a Pre-Written Obituary Might Have Inspired the Nobel Prize. And it turns out that Alfred Nobel's brother died. And everyone and people in France thought it was Alfred, not his brother. So they wrote the obituary about Alfred Nobel. And the title of the obituary was that something to the idea of the merchant of death has died. So he gets to read, Alfred gets to read his own obit and is shocked because, you know, as the creator of dynamite and what he did, and all of a sudden he realized this is his legacy. Does he want this legacy, this idea of the merchant of death? And the story goes that within the next 8 years after he saw this obit that was of himself, not of his brother, he decided he had to do something different. And what we end up finding out is that he leaves his massive wealth. He had no children. He was never married. And he created all these remarkable prizes, the Nobel Prize for Peace, the Nobel Prize in Math, all those Nobel Prizes. And he used his wealth to invest in what is good, to invest in something different. And so what Alfred Nobel figured out was he could rewrite his obituary. So he is remembered today not as the merchant of death, but as the man who basically underwrote all those Nobel Prizes. And we think of them as being so coveted. So when I was writing, you have time to rewrite your obituary, everyone. I'm not talking about the words. I'm talking about your behavior, just to let you know. All right, joining us right now for a Rethink the Week, they're going, why do I do this radio show with this woman? Robert Hockett joined the Cornell Law Faculty in 2004. His principal teaching, research, and writing interests lie in the fields of organizational, financial, monetary law, and economics in both their positive and normative, as well as their national and transnational dimensions. His guiding concern in these fields is with the legal and institutional prerequisites to a just, prosperous, and sustainable economic order. Welcome back to the program, Mr. Hockett.
Thanks, Artie. Really great to be with you again.
Lincoln Mitchell teaches political science and public policy at Columbia University. He's the author of 8 books, and his writings have appeared in CNN, Reuters, the New York Times, NBC, and the San Francisco Examiner. If you want to read more of Lincoln, go to his Substack, Kibitzing with Lincoln. Thank you so much, Lincoln, for doing this.
Good to be here again, Artie.
And Stephen Pimper, you have double dipped. You did Friday's show, and now you're doing Monday's show. You are a senior fellow at the Carsey School of Public Policy at the University of New Hampshire. You are also the author of 4 books. Most recently, your book, Politics for Social Workers, A Practical Guide to Effecting Change, received the 2023 Best Book Award from the Society for Social Work and Research. Welcome back to the program, Stephen. Again, thank you for doing this today as well.
Thank you, Arnie. I've missed you. It's been like 23 hours.
I think so. I know. I am out of my mind. And I'm out of my mind at the Supreme Court for what they have done. And I saw a headline with their decision to take up the case about whether Donald Trump is actually above the law. And as I was thinking about this, I was thinking about they fed into exactly what Donald Trump wants, which is delay. He doesn't want a decision. He wants delay. And then he will work delay so that he will eventually become reelected as president of the United States, or at least that's the plan. And so I guess I'm going to go with you, Lincoln Mitchell. Don't you think the American people have a right to a decision in a timely fashion before they exercise the franchise? And isn't really what the Supreme Court is doing is not only aiding and abetting Donald Trump, not only undermining our faith, not only in government, in elections, in frankly the court, but it's just, it is so shocking because their actions are so damn obvious. And Jack Smith knew when he wanted to basically, you know, hopscotch over the Court of Appeals and go straight to the Supreme Court. And they said, no, go through the process. And then after the Court of Appeals in a unanimous decision comes down with a remarkably worded decision that really basically says there is no question here. He is not. They then drag their knuckles, wait a couple of weeks, and then basically set up the time for this hearing at the end of the session, the last time you can actually have a hearing before the Supreme Court. It is so outrageous. And I just keep thinking they want to undermine the very democracy and constitution they claim to want to protect. And I'm just trying to figure out, how does that set it up for them in the future, let alone for the rest of us, Lincoln?
You said they dragged their knuckles. I don't know if you meant drag their feet, but maybe they're dragging both at this point.
Yes.
Yeah, the only area, thing you said on which I would push back a little bit is I don't find this shocking. The notion that the Supreme Court are these nine men and women in robes who are the priestly class who solve all our problems and save democracy is deeply, deeply destructive and demonstrably false. And it is essential that the American people stop believing that, but even more essential that the American political, judicial, and media elite stop telling the American people that. I would just add a couple of things because, you know, in your very eloquently worded question, you kind of made all the points that I was going to make. But let me just make a couple, three more points here. I'll be brief. I want to stress something. There is no case here. Trump has no case. His legal position is absurd. It is completely indefensible. If you were in a high school, let's say a ninth or 10th grade, learning about maybe you want to go to law school today and did an extracurricular where you had to, you know, pre-law extracurricular and there was a moot court and you presented this case, your ninth or 10th grade social studies teacher would be stifling laughter because you would be presenting such an absurd case. There is no case here, full stop. And everybody who watched a law procedure on television up to spent their life studying the Constitution knows this. It is deeply against both the letter and the spirit of American democracy and the letter and the spirit of founding documents of American democracy. Two more points here. One, when I heard this or saw this on my phone or whatever, when I was walking the dog, I think what struck me is this is not just the Supreme Court enabling Donald Trump, as so many Republicans have, and let's be clear, this is a partisan institution. This to me shows why we as Americans can't govern ourselves, right? We set up these rules, we set up these structures. At the end of the day, we say, oh, we're afraid of Trump and his cult, so let's just give them everything they want. This is really deeply, deeply disturbing because it is a reminder that we can't solve this problem ourselves. There are a large faction of the country just wants to do what Donald Trump wants, just wants to indulge this deeply disturbed fascistic dude. And then lastly, one last word. You know, the nine people on that court all went to elite law schools. They all graduated, most of them graduated from elite undergraduate law schools. These elite institutions have to be held accountable and not in this grandstanding, offensive, right-wing performative way of people like Elise Stefanik who cares much about what's good for the Jews as I care about the National Hockey League, which is nothing, right? But they have to be held accountable. Why are our elite law schools producing people over and over again who are handmaidens of a fascist movement?
So Robert Hocke, you're the lawyer on the panel, and I'm looking at an article from the New Republic. And it's entitled, Liz Cheney Nukes the Supreme Court Over Trump Delay and Hands Dems a Weapon. What she is suggesting is, what percentage of voters know that Trump can cancel prosecutions of himself if he wins back the White House? Now, she's thinking that this is a weapon, but this is exactly, Trump has told them this. I'm just trying to figure out how this is like, this is a shock to us that he could actually, you know, cancel prosecutions against himself. It's, I mean, remember, he's chosen by God, Robert Hockett. You know, this is a monarchy. This is someone who, therefore, of course he can cancel prosecutions because he is immune from anything that represents the rule of law or governing, because he is beyond that. And I am, and I mean, I'm not sure that anything you tell the American people, especially this kind of wild base that is more cult-like, will even penetrate. And I'm wondering whether the vast, maybe this, not even vast middle, whether they will actually be able to process and what that ultimately means when it comes to an election in November, when we're looking at the border being, you know, used as a toxic mix, when we're looking at inflation creating such a resentment and unhappiness, when we're looking at the cost of housing making people apoplectic, they, what do? They blame the guy in charge. And right now that guy's name is Joe Biden. And therefore the man who basically says I can fix everything with no policy prescription to do it sounds like the answer. Because after all, he is the gift from God.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think the thing about the Supreme Court is it's always, in a sense, had to wear a fig leaf. And the reason is fairly clear, right? The reason has often been referred to ever since the days of John Hart Ely, an old constitutional law scholar, as the counter-majoritarian difficulty or the counter-majoritarian dilemma. So the idea is that in a democracy, any institution that is not itself elected and is able to sort of weigh in on fundamental questions is inherently suspect, right? There's something anomalous about any such institution. But the understanding has been that there are a few reasons or a few bases for allowing that within a restricted range. And that's because we're not merely a democracy, we're a constitutional democracy with a Bill of Rights. And the idea then is that some basic fundamental rights, as well as the basic structure of our government, are supposed to be beyond the electoral process, at least in the majority rule sense. You would require essentially a supermajority to sort of change the structure of our government or to sort of override rights in the Bill of Rights. And so the Supreme Court has been viewed then as a kind of necessary evil that we tolerate so long as it, again, restricts itself to this very narrow set of boundaries of basically the rule of law. You can sort of, you can, in a sense, rope in all of these sort of structural matters and all of these basic rights matters as part of the rule of law, meaning it's meant to be above and beyond or outside of the democratic process, again, at least in the mere majority rule sense, as distinguished from the supermajority rule sense. Ironically, though, we now have the Constitution, I mean, we have the Supreme Court stepping outside of those particular boundaries, the only boundaries that legitimize it in the first place, and in the name of and on the behalf of a person who essentially personifies the anti-rule of law or the opposite of the rule of law or contempt of the rule of law.
Exactly.
So it's not only ignoring its own boundaries, it's in effect removing the one fig leaf that it used to be able to wear. And we got sort of a hint of this in Bush versus Gore in 2000, because that was a transparently partisan decision. But at least it got a little bit singed by that and was a little bit more careful afterwards, but only a little, right? We've been getting more and more hints ever since 2000 that this court is effectively contemptuous of the rule of law and contemptuous of democracy altogether. And now, of course, operating in the name of Donald Trump, who is, again, the most dramatic instance of repudiation of the rule of law in our history, in our entire national history, there's just not even a fig leaf anymore. And there's not even a court that seems to care about the lack of its own fig leaf. And so if and when a revolution occurs, it seems to me that the very first thing that's going to happen is that the Supreme Court will be essentially disbanded. It will just be eliminated. There just won't be one anymore. There will simply be plebiscitory mob rule henceforth.
Oh my God. So Stephen, as I'm listening to all of this, I hear Robert Hockett going back to Bush v. Gore. And I guess I agree with him, but I'm also going to go to the man that just announced that he was stepping down. And that's Mitch McConnell. Because if anybody aided and abetted and made it move even swifter, I mean, the dismantling of the institution known as the Supreme Court, it is this Mitch McConnell. I mean, when he got up and talked about all the good things and that the test of leadership, he says, Stephen Pimper, is to know when to leave. And I'm screaming at the TV. That was 10 years ago, honey bun. You're 10 years too late, because the kind of damage that you've done in the last 10 years is unbelievable. And again, there was a wonderful title of an article that Mitch McConnell lost by winning. that every time he won, he dismantled something, whether it was the GOP, whether it was the Supreme Court, whether it was, frankly, democracy, whether it was the credibility of the United States Senate with the demand for supermajorities and gridlock. I mean, every single thing that was, quote, a notch in his belt that was a win destroyed everything. Everything he touched now is rotted out. And I look at this, and that is his legacy. You know, that is his ultimate legacy. And I keep wanting to point to Leonard Leo, or I want to point to Bush v. Gore, or I want to point to all the other things. But I actually think that the man at the center of all this is Mitch McConnell. That is, and he's so good friends with, you know, Joe Biden. They've known each other for years. He's someone you could work with. He's an institutionalist. No, I can't even use the words on radio what he is. But I think in some ways, that's what makes it so frightening, is how much he has contributed to absolutely everything now that is destroying what I perceive as a future of democracy in this country, because I'm not even sure that we're going to get enough of us to exercise the franchise, or that our votes will even be recognized, Stephen Pimpare.
So I spoke about both of these issues on your Friday program. So I will incorporate by reference my remarks from that program, and let me see if I can add something to them. One on McConnell, I think that we also need to take account of the ineffectiveness and the learned helplessness of the Democratic Party, because in that blindness to the ways in which our political systems have, and I align myself with everything that Robert says, but in this period of hyper-partisanship, those institutional flaws baked into the system are revealed even more profoundly, and the power of the minority to rule when given leave by the majority to do so becomes even more urgent. And the Democratic Party has been so concerned with norms in which finding the center, with finding bipartisan solutions, that what they have done has created spaces for that minority to effectively exploit the rules, arguably no better than Mitch McConnell, in order to achieve undemocratic ends. On the court itself, let me just highlight the corruption of it by maybe bringing just a couple of receipts. First of all, before we talk about the I can't find the word for not being held accountable for crimes.
All right, well,
Okay. Immunity. Yeah, there we go.
Immunity. Trump wants immunity.
Right.
We should not lose sight of what's going on in Florida and Judge Eileen Cannon, appointed also by Trump. This is arguably, of all of the cases in front of us, this is the most clear cut, right? This is really clear what happened. He stole stuff. The National Archives spent years trying to recover it. The FBI intervened. He refused. And she has slow walked this case in ways that show some of her own inexperience and incompetence, but also, it seems to me, clearly demonstrate that she is using the judiciary on behalf of a favored political client. In that realm, just a couple of things we should keep in mind when we think about the Supreme Court and get specific. Clarence Thomas's wife was a participant in planning the long-running coup that is the center of Trump's criminal charges and is partaking in deciding these very cases. Moreover, thanks largely to reporting from ProPublica, we know that billionaires have shoveled enormous sums of money and benefits at Clarence Thomas, right? And for folks who want details, there was a lovely John Oliver segment on this last week. And stay for the end, because it's brilliant. Justice Alito, we know, had private planes and fancy expensive fishing trips paid for by some of the same billionaires. Justice Kavanaugh, right, had enormous debts that suddenly disappeared upon his confirmation. Justice Gorsuch had been trying to sell a property for years and years and years, and suddenly after his confirmation, it was sold. These are not merely corrupt institutions, but they are corrupt individuals.
God, that should be a PSA. So as I'm listening to Stephen Lincoln, I keep thinking he's condemning the Democratic Party. And I totally agree. I mean, having run with Bill and Hillary in 1992, I saw how that corruption that you were talking about, because Bill was clearly in the pocket of corporate finance and whatever. And it was, that was really what he ultimately came to achieve. I mean, when I look at all the things he passed in the 8 years, I keep referring to him as a GOP wet dream. I mean, everything that Newt Gingrich ever wanted, Bill Clinton basically passed, okay, and owned it. But one of the stories—
Perhaps we could stay away from that kind of imagery when discussing Bill Clinton.
I'm sorry. But Lincoln, I'm looking at Alex Salmond's piece in Slate magazine, because in a lot of ways, again, it goes to condemning the Democrats. Democrats blew their big opportunity to make New York winnable in 2024. And I just want to read the opening paragraph, because as I read it, I'm like, oh my God. After over a year in court, millions of dollars in lawyers' fees, an overhaul of the state's highest court, and an all-out battle to throw out New York's congressional districts and replace them with something more favorable for Democrats. The New York Senate, empowered with the ability to flip control of the House single-handedly, voted to confirm new maps signed by the governor into law. The results, sit down, everyone. The number of Trump-won districts in the state has now officially increased from 5 to 6. Can I just read that sentence again? The number of Trump-won districts in the state has officially increased from 5 to 6. And as Alex wrote, read that again, it's not a typo. So I'm looking at the Democratic Party and I'm looking at the Republican Party. The Republican Party has given an inch and they take a mile. The Democratic Party has given a mile and they take nothing. I mean, it's just like, as if it's a level playing field, and it is not. And it is not a question of, well, we don't want to be corrupt like them. It's about exercising and understanding their power at the moment. And I am just so, so, so appalled. And I read this and I just wanted to cry. I wanted to cry, Lincoln.
I think you and Stephen have identified two issues. One is the influence of the donor class on curbing the progressive potential of the Democratic Party. And the second is the failure of the Democrats to play hardball. And I would just point out that if you were to hang out with a MAGA crowd, they would say the same thing. It wouldn't be the truth, but they would say the same thing. I would also point out that there are places where the Democrats have played more hardball. Wisconsin, where I am now, they got a much better map because the governor and the legislature played hardball and they were smart about it. So it is possible. But the problem with the Democratic Party is they believe what Stephen was discussing about the corruption of the individuals and the institutions on the Supreme Court. There are many Democratic elected officials, and more importantly, Democrats in the donor class who don't believe that, because they don't want to believe that. We've had many discussions on this show and elsewhere. And I know Stephen has engaged in this a lot with how the Constitution hamstrings American democracy. And the donor class and the elected official class in the Democratic Party doesn't want to believe that because they don't want to believe the platitudes. They want to believe the platitudes about American democracy. And that makes it more difficult for them to play hardball, which is absolutely essential here. Now, I just want to touch on one other point with regards to the first point, which is another problem here. And I want to talk about Bernie Sanders for a minute, because I think that Bernie Sanders' greatest political skill as a politician is that he is able to speak simple truths in simple language. And that is extremely important. Donald Trump's greatest skill is that he's able to tell simple lies in simple language. But the simple economic truths, I think that if I wanted 60 seconds to understand the American economy, if I sat down with Bernie Sanders and I was from another country, I'd walk away with a very good progressive critique. If I sat down with Clinton, Obama, or Biden, I'd walk away totally confused.
Confused. Yeah, no. And let's also remember, and I'm going to toss to you, Robert, as soon as we go to a break, but let's also remember that the brilliance of Bernie Sanders is that he has been saying this for 40 or 50 years. He hasn't morphed. He hasn't mutated. This idea of economic justice has been something he's been talking about ad nauseum. It is the only language he knows. I hear Bernie speeches. I can give them because I've heard them so many times. But that's the brilliance of both his simplicity and the solution. And when we come back from the break, Robert Hockett, I am looking at an NPR story. And the title of the NPR story is, and this is something, again, I think is right up your alley, here's a big reason why people may be gloomy about the economy: the cost of money. the cost of money. And I think, again, you know, we keep hearing about, oh, but look at where we're tackling inflation. Oh, look at the economy. It's more robust than anywhere in the world. And I'm going, robust for whom? With that, it is our Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. What do we call it? We call it Rethink the Week. We will be rejoined by Robert Hockett from Cornell Law, Lincoln Mitchell, who teaches at Columbia University, and Stephen Pepere, a senior fellow at the Carsey School of Public Policy at the University of New Hampshire. Stick around, folks. We will be right back.
A light moment, perhaps, during a blatant attack on freedom of the press. I'm Bill Newman, and this is the Civil Liberties Minute. In Oklahoma, State Senator Nathan Dom has introduced a bill oxymoronically titled the Common Sense Freedom of the Press Control Act. Freedom of the Press Control Act? The proposed law would prohibit any media outlet in that state from publishing or broadcasting unless all the writers have received a license from the state government permitting them to be journalists. Can you say 1984? All writers also would need to complete an 8-hour or longer course titled, ironically, a propaganda-free safety training course, which the law specifies would be developed and taught by PragerU, which describes itself as the world's leading conservative nonprofit focused on changing minds through the creative use of digital media. Wow. The reporters also would be required to take quarterly drug tests. Say what? And also secure $1 million liability insurance policies, which, if they could get them, would make them the target of lawsuits. The managing editor of the Johnston County Sentinel, John Small, correctly characterized the bill as an egregious violation of the First Amendment. The editor added that some journalists in Oklahoma, including him, think the bill's sponsor, Senator Dom, as he put it, may be a couple McNuggets short of a Happy Meal. The Civil Liberties Minute is made possible by the ACLU because freedom can't protect itself.
This is Lincoln Mitchell with today's Mitchell Minute.
Yesterday, Vice President Kamala Harris called for an immediate ceasefire that would last at least 6 weeks, a release of all the hostages that Hamas is holding, and that Israel make it easier for more aid to get into Gaza. These are all very reasonable demands. This is the right position for the United States to be taking. It is the position that the United States should have taken a while ago. But what this demonstrates is that a country as powerful as the United States, an administration as smart and competent as this one, can hold more than one idea in their head at the same time. And the ideas that the hostages must be released. The humanitarian situation in Gaza is terrible, and the civilian death rate is too high. And that the security of the state of Israel is something that is important and that the United States should support. Those are all ideas that can exist at the same time, and those are reflected in the Vice President's statement. And I hope that it moves the process forward in the conflict.
The Mitchell Minute is a daily minute or so of political analysis from me, Professor Lincoln Mitchell. If you want to hear more of my opinion and analysis, you can subscribe to my YouTube channel at Mitchell Minute. Or subscribe to my Substack, Kibitzing with Lincoln.
When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When your eyes are open, when you know the history. When your parents lived through things that looked so much like this. All the indications impossible to miss. When you've sought for your whole life to make the earth a better place. And you once again see the rising of the master race. When you know that they are coming, when they announced it in advance. When you know for many people this will be their last chance. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do? When the time to act is now, and now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when indefinite detention is the new reality for so many children to whom you did not give birth, when you see they're just as precious as every other child on earth, when they're opening the camps not used since the war, where families were imprisoned decades before, when Kristallnacht is coming, they announced it on the news, when the writing's on the wall, when you can see the fuse, then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now, and now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When you know rallies are not helping and silence is complicity. When you know where the kids are kept, locked inside their cells. When you see approaching the future this foretells. When they're coming for your neighbors. When they've even said what day they plan to put them all in buses and take them away. When you know where they keep the buses. You've been to the parking lot. Perhaps a whole lot of petrol bombs is the best move that you got. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933.
Dancing in the dark, walking through the park and reminiscing.
Welcome back to part two of the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. What do we call it? We call it Rethink the Week. When do we tape it? Friday morning. We're rejoined by Robert Hockett from Cornell Law, Lincoln Mitchell from Columbia University, and Stephen Pimper from the Carsey School of Public Policy at the University of New Hampshire. As I'm listening to the conversations, not only am I depressed about how the Democrats are incapable of talking and then ultimately delivering and actually fighting and going to the mat for what they claim to believe in, the idea is that the economics of what's happening today, if I hear one more time how good the economy is, and then I watch statistics coming out of my state, let me give you one, Robert Hockett. So I'm on the air this morning on a conservative station, and I saw that the Meals on Wheels program in Manchester is about to open a new facility. And why is Meals on Wheels opening up a new facility? Because the number of people who sought out Meals for on Wheels doubled from 2022 to 2023. Can I repeat that? Robert, it doubled. We are one of the richest states in the nation. We are sitting on more money than you could possibly get. And yet they're seeing the number of people who need Meals on Wheels doubling from 2022 to 2023. And then I am looking at what's happening for kids and lunches in public schools. And what do I notice? Vermont, Maine, and Massachusetts, all the states surrounding my little state, Robert Hockett, all provide free lunch for nothing. They don't have to qualify. They don't have to be the 135% of poverty, 350% of poverty. Niente. You come to school. If you want a free lunch, you get a free lunch. What about my state? My state, you have to be at 135% of poverty level, which is like ridiculously poor, or a little bit higher in order to get a free and reduced lunch. Okay. And here's the kicker. So someone just sent me a note this morning that in her little tiny town with no high school, these are just elementary kids and middle school kids, the amount of debt to the school system for unpaid lunches in her teeny tiny town is $25,000. These are kids that need to eat but can't pay for that lunch. So I am looking at all this and it is such an opportunity, but it is being undermined by people that basically claim that they're on the Democratic side. But yet what they don't deliver is an economics and an economic policy that actually will benefit the majority of Americans.
Yeah, so two quick things. The first, to sort of re-up an idea that we've talked about before, in order to sort of play, for the Democrats to play hardball, as Lincoln quite importantly suggested or urged before, and in order for the Dems to play hardball in a way that addresses the corruption of the Supreme Court as an institution and the justices as individuals, as Stephen rightly emphasized, I think we're basically going to have to do something that we can think of as the contrary of what we sometimes hear Democrats calling for. They keep saying, let's pack the court, i.e. let's add more seats. My argument, as you know, on this show before has been, no, we have to unpack the court. There are at least four members of that court who would be easily investigated or indicted for committing actual crimes, right? Not just for, you know, sort of misjudging or misbehaving on the Supreme Court, but for having committed crimes on the way to the Supreme Court and for having committed crimes while on the Supreme Court. There's no reason that we can't indict and prosecute those four and then impeach and remove them and replace them. So if we're going to keep a Supreme Court at all, it seems to me we have to unpack it, not pack it. Now, getting more directly to the economic point that you were just raising again, I'm going to plug something else, which is a book that I've got coming out later this year. And I won't talk too much about the book, but I'll just make this observation that sort of is responsive to what you said and also sort of lays the predicate for the book. one way to sort of look at the American economy over the last 40 or 50 years is by remembering the old political economy distinction between capital and labor, right? There's a small number of us Americans, or so-called Americans, who basically own virtually everything, right? So people will often say, well, come on, everybody's got a 401k, everybody's got some stocks or bonds in their retirement accounts. If you look at the actual distribution, if you look at the actual numbers, which are what matter, about 90% of the productive assets of the country are owned by fewer than 10%, indeed closer to 5% of our population. So you've got the owners on the one hand, and then those who basically work for wages or salaries on the other hand. And the crucial point is those wages and those salaries are basically what the owners agree to convey to us. Sometimes owing to pressure put on them by legislators, more often owing to pressure put onto them, on them by labor and the like, right? Labor unions and the like. It seems to me that what we see in the last 40 or 50 years is a clear reflection of that. Basically, the returns to capital have gone higher and higher and higher over the last 50 years, whereas real wage income and real salary income has either stagnated or declined in real terms, right, adjusted for inflation. For that reason, it seems to me, and I think this is even more urgent now that AI is beginning to pass bar exams and medical exams, we're going to have to move to a completely new model of production in this particular economy. And that is, we're all going to have to become owners or co-determiners of what our productive units do. The Germans, of course, for a long time have had labor co-determination of large corporations where the boards are actually named half by labor and half by capital. At the same time, we could easily make capital more readily available and make the cost of money much lower to finance worker buyouts of their own companies and worker formation of their own co-ops and own companies. We're going to have to move, in other words, to a model where most of us own the productive units that we work for or co-determine the productive units that we work for, rather than simply being employed by, i.e. bribed by, or given table scraps by the 5 or 10% of Americans who own all of the rest. The book is called A Republic of Producers. It's coming out with Yale University Press this very year, sort of showing both why and, more importantly for our purposes, I think, how to do that. But I think that's basically inevitable at this point.
And Robert, before you wrote the book many, many years ago in the 1980s, and I'm going to turn to you, Lincoln, and that is that what I did was I worked with a group of manufactured housing renters. And what we know about mobile homes is the idea of the word mobile is a fiction. They're not mobile. They're immobile. They're stuck in place. And yet they were vulnerable to the people that actually owned the parks. And one of the great achievements, or one of the things that we ultimately helped to create happen, was the idea that these mobile manufacturing housing parks would be given a right of first refusal before the owner sold the property out from under and then left them vulnerable either to not have a place to put their home or basically to see the impossibility of them being able to stay in place because the rents had gotten so high. And when you go into a park that is owned by the people that live there, there is such a sense of celebration. There is such a sense of ownership. There is such a sense of pride. And to a large extent, Lincoln, I almost feel sometimes like we need to use these simple examples and say, look what it does in that setting. Imagine what it would do in the other aspects of work. So sometimes we get so complex, but if we just show them what it means in that simple setting, imagine what it will mean in other aspects of your life. That is what I mean. That's why I love the idea of the public option for credit cards. What I love the idea of the public option for healthcare. It's about, you know, giving us something that we collectively can choose. And then suddenly you realize how much better it is for our families and our economy. And we run away from what I think, Lincoln, is so simple. As you were saying, is that Bernie did it in a simple way, and the answers are so obvious, we just never share them or repeat them, Lincoln.
And to maybe link this to what we were saying before the break, this is precisely the influence the donor class has on the Democratic Party.
Exactly.
That they simply do not discuss these things. Yeah. So it is. So every now and then, I was actually on an airplane yesterday, Every now and then when there's a problem with the airlines, I'll turn to someone next to me and I'll say, this is what happens when you leave things in the hands of the private sector. And the reason I say that is because we hear so much anytime, you know, there's a line at the DMV, oh, business could do this better, right? So people need to hear the other side of that. But, and I want to just give one illustrative example of something Robert Hockett was saying. I teach a class of at this moment, there were 60 students in the class. This was a couple falls ago. About half to 60% were American. And I said, if you are American, how do you buy your first home? Assuming you don't have a very, very high paying job on Wall Street or something like that. And they all basically said, your parents have to be able to give you a down payment.
Yes, exactly.
That's how you get. So that means that home ownership is essentially not accessible to a lot of people. Now, what I would say is that I think that when you have good rent control laws, people can have pride in the apartments that they rent. I'm not comfortable saying that if you don't own, it's not somehow not a home.
No,
right?
No.
When renters are protected legally, you have a similar dynamic. But the point, and this ties back also to, you know, why people aren't buying that the Biden economy is so great. The deep structural problems. I'm always remembered of when John McCain said the fundamentals of the economy are sound, right? Everybody wanted to yell, no, that's the exact wrong way to look at what's going on.
Right.
But these are deep problems. Other countries, for example, Germany, they organize management labor relations in a way that is much, much better for everybody, not least the workers, right? Other many, many countries do healthcare better. They do education better. And the reason for that is that in democracies, government can play a role. And that there are, when people say, you know, the official position of the Democratic Party, going back certainly to Clinton and probably earlier, is that shrinking government. And we've had hiccups along the way, you know, the Inflation Reduction Act. But we are not going to, so we've had a half century at least experiment, probably longer, probably 2.5 centuries, with letting the private sector solve these problems. How much longer is this experiment going to fail before we try other things? And how, and when we keep repeating this, basically the Democratic Party, if they're going to have the same economic approach as the Republicans, then you're just going to allow, then you're going to push people who share some of those populist views away from the Democratic Party. If you embrace some of these more thoughtful ways, you're going to have a chance to at least speak to new voters in new ways.
So Stephen, I'm looking at a couple of articles that have come out actually all on the same theme. And the theme is the theme of immigration. And it was an article from the New York Times. It was actually an article in the Wall Street Journal. It's like all of a sudden, and it's entitled, "The U.S. Economy is Surpassing Expectations. Immigration is one reason. Immigrants aided the pandemic recovery, may be crucial to future needs. The challenge is processing newcomers and getting them where the jobs are." And the reason I love this story is that, you know, we see Abbott spending billions of dollars trying to figure out how to keep those immigrants from those refugees from coming across the border. You see him flipping the bird at the Supreme Court when they say, no, that's a federal job, it's not a state job. You see him bring the conga line of Republican governors down to the border, and then you see Trump and Biden both at the border. And yet, in an interesting way, they're not talking about not only that we should make a rational process, but the value of immigrants. And the reason I bring this up, Stephen, is that as you hear Governor Abbott going after all those undocumented coming across the border, do you know who he never talks about? He never talks about the 600,000 undocumented immigrants that live in and around Houston. And you know why? Because they're essential for the economy of Houston. They're essential for the economy of the oil and gas industry. They're essential for the agricultural industry. So as he points the finger at the undocumented that's coming across the border, what he doesn't acknowledge is how essential they are for the thriving economy you are seeing in Texas and many other places in this country. So once again, the messaging here is always a toxic message. The messaging here isn't how do we create a legal system so that people can come through, but understand the vitality of America is so much premised on this, and we never hear that conversation. All of a sudden now I'm seeing this in the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times. Why? Because business is hysterical, because they know the truth.
So arguably, this has always been a tension in U.S. immigration policy, right? You've got sort of the xenophobia, the fear of the other, the I'm here, I'm closing the door behind me, get the hell away, right, crowd. And then you've got those who recognize not merely the economic benefits in crude terms, right? You've got laborers who you can exploit to build the railroad, for example, right? But also among more enlightened folk, the recognition that part of what has allowed the United States to build some of the best universities on the planet is the sheer intellectual and cultural diversity that inhabits the country. And I think we underestimate how important that has been to the extent that we have been able to be vibrant and creative and those kinds of things. I want to flip back to the conversation about this disconnect between people's feelings about the economy and sort of the aggregate data that tell those people they shouldn't feel that way and everything is great. What are they talking about? There's a principle in behavioral economics that offers good research that people feel a loss much more than they feel an equivalent gain.
Yeah,
right? A loss registers much, much more with us. Think back to our very recent history, right? In the pandemic, we radically expanded the U.S. welfare state overnight, right? We created what was essentially a national unemployment insurance program instead of this bifurcated state-level system, fully funded it, expanded benefits, increased the number of people who are eligible, increased access to food stamps, created universal breakfast and lunch programs pretty much everywhere across the country, radically expanded the child tax credit, made it deliverable monthly to almost every household with children in the United States. And then we took all of that away.
Exactly.
Right. So we, as a consequence, cut the national poverty rate in half over the course of 1 year. And then the following year doubled it. Right. People feel that, right? I don't understand why people are struggling so hard and why they find this mysterious, right? We use the power of the state to demonstrate to people that the United States government has the ability to make their lives a little better and a little more secure. And then we said, yeah, you know what? We're not really interested in doing that. You're on your own.
And you know what's interesting, Robert Hockett, is that the Republicans could not talk about this sense of despair during the pandemic because of all this economic safety nets. Every single aspect, as you point out, from a healthcare perspective, from a food perspective, from a child credit perspective, I mean, they checked off all the boxes. The only box, Robert Hockett, that they could not check off because it was a public health issue was the question of vaccinations. So look where the Republicans went. They went from they said, aha, they're taking away your freedom. They're not allowing you to go to church without a mask. They're telling you must be vaccinated. So look where they went. They had to have a distraction from what was actually stabilizing people's lives during a time when it should have been the most frightening and the most unstable. And where did they go after? They went after public health. They went after this idea of vaccines, and we're seeing the consequences of that having such a lasting effect, Robert, because look at the measles outbreak in Florida. Oh my God, Robert. And people keep saying, oh, it's Florida. I said, where does everybody go for spring break? Okay, let's just remember this, Robert. We all go to Florida for spring break. And what are we going to bring home if we have an infant? We're going to bring home measles. So what happens in Florida doesn't stay in Florida. And again, I almost wonder, I mean, look at this bait and switch, but the only constant has been, instead of continuing to invest in people's lives, we took it away, and the Republicans had the only constant. The fear of taking away your liberty, the fear of the vaccine, the fear of being told what to do for the purposes of your choice of your health. And that was the only thing that stayed the same. And so ultimately, we understand why the Republican base is able to build on something, because they had the only constant. That lie consistently stayed the same. And we took away the one thing that we actually had, which was to improve people's lives. Oh my God, Robert.
Yes.
How do we get to people?
So two quick things here. First, I know Lincoln and Stephen have both emphasized in the past how opportunistic the Republican claim about claim to be concerned about the budget, or the Republican claim to think austerity to be a categorical imperative tends to be, right? They both pointed out in past shows, right, that when the Republicans are actually in power, or when they have the White House, they don't seem to have any scruples at all about mass expenditures. It's just, of course, that the expenditures are on other things, but they don't worry the least bit about the deficit or anything of that sort. They don't talk about getting our fiscal house in order or any such thing, right, when they're in office. But then, of course, when they're out of office, then they talk about it. And of course, it happens that when they're out of office, such expenditures tend to be more often than not on human beings. Although, as we know, the mainstream Dems are pretty big on heavy defense spending and that kind of thing as well. But at least there's some show of concern for the general well-being of the populace, and that the Republicans don't care about. The second thing, relatedly, is it's sort of odd. It's almost as though you could make this into a kind of an algorithm or a formula. Basically, if it's something that's good for people in general or good for the natural environment in general, Republicans will not only oppose it, but they'll mock it, right? So, of course, they mock all of the public health initiatives that were taken during the pandemic, at least once they're out of office. It's ironic that some of those initiatives were actually taken by the Trump administration. But once they're out of office, at least, they mock all of the public health initiatives. And remember how they sort of poked fun of Obama during the campaign of 08, holding those tire pressure thingies up in the air. To mock concern about, you know, basically the emissions, automotive emissions that are apparently up higher when your tires aren't properly filled. I don't know what it is about them, but it's almost as though snark is itself a kind of virtue, right? It almost doesn't matter what the subject matter of the particular incidents of or incident of snark is. If there's something to sort of show snark about, they will show snark. It's as though this is their sensibility. There's some kind of deep anger inside, it seems to me, of a lot of these Republicans. And I'm often tempted to wonder what it comes from. Were they beaten up in high school? Did they prove to be sort of inadequate in bed with girlfriends? I mean, what is it that accounts for this strange kind of snark, the sort of resentment-fueled snark that is their dominant sensibility and their dominant personality trait, no matter what the issue that's being discussed, but especially if it's a matter of mocking things that are actually good for everybody?
Well, but there's the resentment. They owned the bench. They owned the bench. White men owned the bench. And suddenly, because the jobs disappeared that paid them $22 and $27 an hour in the late 60s and the early 70s, suddenly the men that owned the bench, they had to expand the bench to women, to blacks, to Hispanics. Think about this. This is their loss. And now what they want to do is they want to push all those people on the bench out again. They want them gone again.
Bob Dylan's Lonesome Death of Hattie Carroll is the story.
Yes,
I recommend that to everybody, right?
It totally is the story, and it just shocks me. But before I let you go,
I think we may be speaking to a very limited audience when Robert Hockett obscures references a deep Bob Dylan cut, and we all nod our heads knowingly and begin singing the lyrics to ourselves.
Yes, exactly. As I'm listening to this, I keep thinking, so then where do we find the ability to sort of do the math, tell the story? Because right now, between the gerrymandering, right now, Robert Hockett, between, you know, the money in politics, you know, Leonard Leo sitting on billions of dollars, I mean, all these things that make it so difficult for us to not only convey the message, but then tailor the message to the result. You know, again, I go back to Florida over and over again. Florida raised their minimum wage despite every politician being opposed to it. Florida, you know, gave ex-felons the right to exercise the franchise despite every politician, but they did not connect the policy with the people. And that is to me, that is the greatest crush, is that they know what they wanted, but the only people that would ultimately make what they wanted actually come to fruition wasn't the people they voted for, but the people they rejected. And I guess that's my question to you. What's that algorithm? How do I make that change? Because that you cannot connect people to policy, to me, is the greatest failure of the Democratic Party.
I think Lincoln has a lot more wisdom on this one than me. So if you don't mind, I'd like
So Lincoln, so what do I do? What do I do, Lincoln? Well, I'm so angry.
I mean, we don't have a lot of time here, but I would say two things here. One,
yes,
if you want to win voters over on economic issues, talk about economic issues and embrace economic policies that work for them. Stop trying to sell them on a kind of tampered down economic royalism, a tampered down economic neoliberalism. The people who are economically suffering, regardless of race, regardless of gender, regardless of ethnicity, location, etc., are not going to buy that.
Yeah.
So stop trying to sell them that. And the second thing is, this is a radical idea for a democratic system. I'm going to throw it out there. Go out and talk to people. And then when you're done with that, go out and talk to more people. And by talk to, I mean actually get with people and speak to them face to face and listen to them. Robert raised this point about snark and anger. I think the word you were looking for but couldn't find was incel. But the reason we see so much snark and anger and sarcasm, which, and I am, look, I'm a sarcastic left-wing Jew from New York, right? So I get that a little bit. But the reason we see that is that the social media algorithms pull people in based on those three emotions. So get away from that and go and talk to people in economic terms about economic issues that resonate with them.
So I'm going to let all of you go, but you know that I spoke at Harvard last week, and the students that I spoke to were very knowledgeable, very engaged with politics, but totally disengaged with participating in the 2024 election. That the level of disgust about Gaza, about the economy, about healthcare was so pervasive in the room. And yet, let me just say something. As I left, the thing that I told this last week, one of the students that I thought was the most remote in that room, who was so angry, left the room immediately. But then she came back and grabbed my arm and said to me, "Why aren't you running for president?" And I did exactly what you said, Lincoln. I talked to them. I talked to them. It was physical. It was in their face. I held their hand. I heard their words. I mirrored back what they said. And guess what? That's what they heard. So there is potential, but you're absolutely right. We have to talk to them. Joining us for our Rethink the Week is a fabulous panel of guests. We have Robert Hockett from Cornell Law, Lincoln Mitchell from Columbia, and Stephen Pimpera, senior fellow at the Carson School of Public Policy at the University of New Hampshire. Thank you, gentlemen, for a remarkable conversation. This, everyone, is the Monday edition. Ciao. We'll talk on Tuesday. You better-